From the Lynn to Grant University in Urbana, Champaign, Illinois, this is a special edition of the Closing Market Report, presentations from the 2025 Farm Assets Conference, Trade, Transportation, and the Global Markets. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today, we're diving into the complex world of global grain markets and the critical infrastructure that keeps them moving. Joining us are Colin Waters from the Illinois Corn Growers Association and Mark Wilson, a farmer and chairman of the U.S. Grains and Bioproducts Council. We'll explore the bright spots in corn exports and the vital role of the Mississippi River Basin and rail networks in transporting these assets, from the aging lock and dam systems in Illinois to the rising global demand for ethanol. We'll begin our discussion by asking Mark and Colin to introduce themselves.
So my name is Colin Waters. I'm the Director of Exports and Logistics here at Illinois Corn. So our offices are just a few steps down the hall. So my role is primarily working in export market development. I work really, really closely with folks at the U.S. Grains and Bioproducts Council. And, right now I would say that, the exports of corn and corn products are probably one of the few bright spots that we have right now in the market. So hopefully we can keep pushing that.
Yeah, my name is Mark Wilson. I'm a farmer up in Stark County, Illinois. I raise corn, soybeans, and custom raise some hogs. I'm chairman of the U.S. Grains and Bioproducts Council for this year. And U.S. Grains and Bioproducts represents corn, barley, sorghum, ethanol, and DDGs. And in everything except sorghum, we're seeing record exports this year.
Let's start on the transportation side. This is one of the areas that you specialize in, Colin. Transportation in the United States for grains, can you talk about the systems that are assets to Illinois, whether they be rail or truck, and or, of course, our Mississippi River Basin?
Illinois is situated in a really special place in the United States, to be perfectly honest. There's a lot of farmers outside of Illinois that would love to be able to access the freight networks that we have available to us. So the fact that Chicago's the kind of the center hub for the U.S. in terms of rail, we have every Class One railroad, and oftentimes some of those rail lines will parallel too, so there's some competition amongst the railroads. For the gentleman that was talking about out in Montana, I lived out there for a while. You have one option, on the BNSF, and if the BNSF wants X dollars, you pay it, and that ultimately will come out of the farmer's pocket. But I think the real asset, the real difference maker for folks in Illinois is the waterway system. It's an incredibly efficient system, and although we believe that it could be far more efficient, it certainly is. It's a huge benefit, and you can see that in basis numbers just over time. So, actually, my colleague Jim Tarman, who's sitting in the back there, has been working on lock and dam infrastructure for the past 30 years, Jim. He's gotten a little bit done, but he's still got some more work to do. Another 30 years, Jim, and I think he'll get it done. But the trouble with waterways is, you have high water, you have low water. There's some seasonality built into that, but it's a huge, huge benefit for farmers.
Hey, Jim, can you come forward for just a second and talk about the things that still need to be done or what's on the list, possibly? Or do you want Colin to do it? Because that was my next question. I was going to follow up with him. What efficiencies do we not have that you think we should have in the system, in the waterway system? What do we have left to build out? And I'll bring a microphone to you so that you don't have to walk all the way up. Jim, of course, is with the Illinois Corn Growers Association.
Our system that we've been working on for, as Colin mentioned, for some 30, 35 years, the locks and dams on the system were built in the 30s and 40s, and by golly, they were only expected to you know, last like 50 years. Most of the locks and dams in the system now are 75 years plus. On one hand, I'll commend the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, who's in charge of keeping them operational and as efficient as they can, has done a good job. But also, on the other hand, I could criticize them for not keeping up and not pushing forward and not staying focused on the areas of need. Back in 2002, I think, our focus began on a program called NESP, Navigation and Ecosystem Sustainability Program, which in essence was where the real bottleneck was within the Upper Mississippi River system. And that exists on locks 20 through 25 on the Mississippi and the LaGrange and Peoria, LaGrange and Peoria lock there. Those were determined the locks that were costing you as farmers and landowners the most inefficiency, if you will. So fast forward, we got authorization and approval for those locks and dams, but you know, and we said, hey, we've got this, we're just about there. Well, authorization does not provide you funding, and then we started down the path of funding. And up until the FY 2022, when we finally pushed the ball over the hill and received IIJA funding for the first NESP lock, if you will, Lock 25, which is in Winfield, Missouri, we received $700,000 at the time. We not only received partial, we thought we were only going to get partial funding, but we received $732 million. That was supposed to complete it from start to finish. And again, we said, yay, we finally are going to start improving our system, until the Corps went back doing one of their reevaluations of how much it's actually going to cost. And now that cost is now $2.2 billion. So we have less than half of the funding that we need to do that. So now we're back in the the mode of trying to get the Corps to focus on specific things. Where's the money going to come from? We're still moving forward, but it's not quite as fast as what we thought initially was going to be.
And that improvement in efficiency is doubling the length of the locks?
Yes, they are. I'm sorry, I just
from
assume everybody understands it like I have for the last 30 years. So those locks that I mentioned, they're all 600-foot locks. You know, back in the 30s and 40s, everybody, you know, during the New Deal, everybody probably thought, man, what a boondoggle this is, because, you know, we were steam-powered paddle wheel pushing through 600-foot locks. I mean, they were way too big. Well, a modern tow now is 1,200 foot, and so a double lockage generally takes, give or take, 2 to 2.5 hours. So anyway, what's being proposed through NESP is 1,200 foot locks at those locations I mentioned, and depending on how much traffic's around there, that'll cut that down to a half an hour or less for them to transit through those locks and dams.
Thank you very much, Jim, and thank you. I appreciate you taking some time. Jim Tarman is with the Illinois Corn Growers Association. If you drive through Peoria on Interstate 474, and my mother-in-law is from the other side of Peoria from here, and so I go by this all the time. Jim, you'll have to help me. Is the crane that lifts the dam steam-powered there? Do you remember?
It used to be.
Used to
up
be.
Until about 8 to 10 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. So this is one of the unique things about that dam in Peoria. If you go by, sometimes when the river's high, the dam is down. It's actually a folding dam, and you'll see a little steam-powered, what was a steam-powered crane, that will reach down. It's got a hook on it, and pull pickets up one at a time to close that dam up when things are low, and they can then lock through the area. It's just extraordinary, the kind of things that have happened over the centuries, now century, I suppose, that allows corn and other products, soybeans, to go downriver, coal, anhydrous ammonia to come upriver, other things, fertilizer as well. So, Mark, let's talk a little bit about what demand is. What do you think, from the U.S. Grains Council, is the best option for future demand for corn outside of the United States at this time?
Well, ethanol. By far, ethanol. I just talked with the head of POET, Doug Bourbon, and he's more excited now than he's ever been with ethanol. He said before RFS 1, 2, he said he's more excited now with the potential for ethanol. And a lot of that is due to all the countries around the world adopting 10%, 15%. India's going to 20% ethanol in their fuels. The big one nobody's talking about, which could be huge, is maritime fuels. Maersk, which is the number two shipping company, uses 6 billion gallons a year. They're doing a test right now with a engine that will do half methanol, half ethanol. And there's a lot of talk that they're wanting to get out of this bunker crude, which is dirty, just black, smoky fuel, to get that out. And so that could be a huge market, because that's number two. That's not all the market. So there's a lot going on with that. Cooking fuel, India, if they adopt, because right now they're using dung cakes and sticks and coal to cook with in a lot of the villages. If they adopt clean burning ethanol cook stoves, which we've done studies and done some pilots with them, if they adopt 1% of the people cooking the other way, ethanol cook stoves, that's 40 million gallons right there. 40 million gallons for 1%. And if we can get 10%, that's 400 million gallons. So there's a lot of this going on all over. Corn, like I said, corn, we're at record levels on exports. We're already above last year's, already this year. Mexico's just been huge. They're just continuing to increase their production down there, and that's going up every year. I know we talked about whether you hate Trump, love Trump, doesn't matter. There's 35 countries that we have agreements, frameworks, executive orders, whatever, done with. And in the past, when we did trade agreements, it took 2 to 7 years to get a trade agreement. These have been done in 2 to 5 months. The only problem is these are executive orders, and anybody can come in. Trump himself can change them. But right now, we're seeing a lot of excitement out there. This is more excitement than we've had in decades to trade, to getting out there and making deals, making things happen, and we're seeing that.
Are you concerned at all that these are simply executive orders and that a change in administration will mean that they simply won't be enforced, even if they're not rejected?
It depends on how well they work. I mean, you look at the steel tariffs, they were put on by Trump. Biden extended them and made them stronger. So if these are working and we're seeing product move, I don't see why a president would want to stop that.
Jet to fuel, I mean, ethanol to fuel on the liquid side. What do you think about that one, and how close might it be? Both of you can comment on this, because it appears, Colin, you have something to say.
Ethanol to jet, that's what.
Yeah, ethanol to jet. Sorry, yeah. Yes.
I think that there's, in the last couple of years, there's been a lot of press and a lot of discussion about ethanol to jet. And so, for those who aren't familiar, basically, jet fuel is more or less kerosene. And what you can do is you can break the ethanol molecule down and then rebuild it into a drop-in fuel, or close to a drop-in fuel. The technology exists. It's not just a theoretical thing, but it hasn't been really commercialized yet. I believe the plant in Georgia has restarted, but that's a more or less a demonstration facility, and I think that they're max is like 10 million gallons or something like that. I can't remember exactly what it is. So today, most of the sustainable aviation fuel that's available in the market, all of it is derived from oils. So whether it's beef tallow or used cooking oil or soybean oil, palm oil, whatever. And I suspect that. That will increase a little bit, but there's a limit. We do have a limit on how much vegetable oil is available in the world right now, and so that's why there's a lot of interest in alcohol to jet or ethanol to jet fuel. I'm optimistic, but I think that's probably a 5 to 10 year type timeline, and that's me being maybe a little bit optimistic about it, I suppose. I think it'll come, but I don't think it's going to be the panacea that I think some people have maybe made it out to be.
Yeah, I think the price of it is the big thing. It's about three times the cost of regular AV fuel by the time they go through everything. And I think that is a hindering point without some type of support by governments or something to get that through. It's going to be a little harder. But Japan is pretty well, they are pushing hard on this. And they're pushing that they think that alcohol to jet is the way to go. And they are seriously looking at building plants that are, the carbon sequestration is huge with them, because they're all about carbon and getting that score as low as possible. And if they can get the carbon sequestration, that makes our ethanol way better to get into that fuel.
And one thing that I do want to note, just what Mark was talking about in carbon intensity, that's a really key part of all of this in terms of the sustainable aviation fuel. For it to be considered sustainable aviation fuel, it right now, at least under the international kind of guidelines, is it has to meet at least a 50% reduction in carbon intensity. And so that's something that's really, really important, kind of and this foundational issue, is that in order for ethanol to jet to become a reality, the process of you know, breaking the molecule apart, rebuilding it, all of that adds carbon intensity. Right, so your beginning ethanol feedstock has to be at a low enough carbon intensity that it can be manipulated and built into SAF, sustainable aviation fuel, to reach that 50% target at least. That's the way that it works. So as farmers, I think that we're, and I've said this before, keep saying it probably, we're going to be talking about carbon intensity more and more and more. This is going to become a part of the vocabulary, and I don't know how this is all going to play out, that if there will be kind of incentives for practice changes or anything else, but I can foresee a future where commodities are potentially marketed with certifications on what your carbon intensity is. This is going to be getting more and more complicated, I think, as time goes on.
These CI scores are driven on the global front. Oftentimes, the carbon intensity score is part of the climate change discussion. How do the politics in the United States play into that issue, and what might be a marketplace for corn on the world stage, but needs to be ready to go out of the United States?
Well, I guess from what I've seen in conversations that I've had with folks from really all over the world, most everyone else is continuing in a push to decarbonize their energy sectors. That's the broadest brush that I could use. Even in the United States right now, we're the current administration is kind of dialing back on some of the measures, whether it's the CAFE, NHTSA standards, your fuel efficiency standards that new vehicles are required to meet. That's, it's getting dialed back, but it's basically what it's doing is just kind of affecting the trajectory. Right, it's not that it's completely falling off. It's just moderating a bit. So, the push for biofuels really around the world is, it's happening regardless. Mark had mentioned the push for E20 blending in India. Well, that has more to do with air quality issues. And to be perfectly honest, I think it has a lot more to do with local economic development. Half the population in India is involved with farming. We know how important biofuels are to the farm economy here. It's the same thing in India, right? The Japanese have made commitments through the Paris Accord or other, but they're also looking at their refining industry on a real steep decline. So they're trying to innovate and make their kind of rejuvenate their refining sector to prop that up. So there's other reasons, I guess, for countries pursuing biofuel policies outside of just purely, climate stuff.
And I'd say the other thing is ethanol is the cheapest source of octane out there. So if they want to add octane, they can make their gas cheaper. They add ethanol to it, and that makes, Japan's looking at, we keep talking about Japan, but that's a huge market. They're going to E10 in their gasoline, and when they get to E10, which they say by 2030 they'll be E10, that's a 1 billion gallon market. Right now we're shipping 100 million gallons over there. That's a billion gallon market with a B. And they will probably source 85% of that from the U.S. Because they don't want to put all their eggs in one basket. They want to diversify a little bit, but they are great trading partners. They like dealing with us. They have a goal of 10% SAF by 2030, and I think everybody knows they're not going to be able to make that. That's just too big of a jump, but they are on a path to get that done, to work through that. So the other countries are still continuing to move forward on things, and they know that presidency is in the U.S. It's only a four-year term, so they're not going to stop everything for that.
Mark, what is the U.S. Grains and Bioproducts Council doing on the front of the other grains, sorghum and wheat? And I'm asking this question because it sure would be nice if Kansas and the Dakotas planted more wheat acres and or more sorghum acres and fewer corn acres, so that that could be an Illinois-Iowa thing.
I don't have anything to do with wheat. That's the wheat growers. I don't mess with them. We have sorghum, and sorghum took a huge hit. 85% of all sorghum exported went to China. 65% of all sorghum grown in the U.S. went to China. They bought nothing last year.
We need wheat and sorghum not to be a feedstock in the United States because it's so located so much closer to the feedlots. Any final words from the two of you?
I would just say, as a former wheat and barley guy, the best thing that you can do to help those wheat and barley farmers is drink more beer and eat more bread. It's 5 o'clock somewhere, I'd say.
No barley, no beer. That's what my daughter worked for Anheuser-Busch for a while, and that's what they say in the Dakotas. Give them a nice round of applause. Thank you very much. Mark Wilson and Colin Waters, take a few minutes. I'll call you back.
You've been listening to the Trade, Transportation, and Global Markets presentation from the Farm Assets Conference with Mark Wilson and Colin Waters on this edition of the Closing Market Report that came to you from Illinois Public Media.